I'm Gina Puglisi, and I am the Vice President of Premier Safety Institute, and I am absolutely delighted to welcome you to our session. And green is a very hot topic in healthcare, and we have 45 minutes to share with you some very exciting things, and so we'll get started. I have the pleasure of introducing Blair Sadler, our first speaker, and I'll be speaking right after him and sharing you a little bit about what Premier is doing in the green space. You have a handout packet on your table, and in that packet are a number of documents and materials about the Premier's green program, as well as handouts from Blair Sadler. The handouts that you have there, the slides, are more slides than he's going to be covering. But we thought there were a lot of background slides that had some great information for those of you that are interested in further information on many of the topics that he's going to be discussing. Blair is a president emeritus of Ratty Children's Hospital and Healthcare Center in San Diego, and he has a wealth of knowledge around green and issues that are important to CEO and boards. He's a fellow of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. He's been on the faculty of Yale. He has been affiliated and served in consulting capacities on committees with Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the National Institute of Health, the U.S.-Mexican Border Health Commission, many professional activities. He's an author of 3 books, and he's also on the board of the Center for Health Design. So he comes with a wealth of expertise that he's going to share with you today. Blair Sadler.
Good morning. How are we doing? Don't have that late morning lag yet? Okay. I'm delighted to be with you today, and Rick Norling is a great friend. We both live in San Diego, and in case you didn't know, San Diego is now part of the United States. And you don't need a visa to get there or a tetanus shot or an extra passport. I'm going to deal with the safe part, and Gene is going to talk more about the green part. So if you think about the next 45 minutes, we're going to cover a lot of ground. It's going to feel a little like a drink of water from a fire hose. So strap in. We're going to cover a lot. We will stick around for questions. But I'd like you to hold questions until Gina does her part. So I'm going to focus on safety within the walls of the hospital, and Gina's going to focus on the green initiative, much of which is external as well as internal. So this is a picture of Children's Hospital of San Diego, which for the first 25 years I was CEO there was called San Diego Children's Hospital. Ernest Rady is actually his name. And when someone gives you $60 million, if he wants to name the hospital after him, that's just fine. He was actually a former chairman of our board of trustees and a terrific person. But what you'll see about that is it doesn't look and feel like a hospital. It was designed to provide a very different environment for kids, and this pavilion was built in the early 90s. And the fact that we tried as a children's hospital where 2/3 of our patients, hospitalized patients, are under 4, it's a very different patient experience. And so we tried to create an environment that was calming and playful and childlike and easily open to the outside and more home-like than a hospital. And that the reaction from parents and kids, our older kids, and particularly the workforce of this half of our number of beds compared to the other part of the hospital that had been built starting in the 50s was remarkable. It was just truly remarkable. They really enjoyed being there. This was all based on intuition. The architect saying, what do we want this to feel like? And here's one of our happy patients in a healing garden. And another thing we did after the new pavilion opened in 93 was to try to make the rest of the physical spaces feel as much like the new Rose Pavilion, as it's called. And then we got into external spaces, which, depending on your climate, like more like Phoenix or San Diego, you can do a lot of things internally as well. And I want to tell you this very quick story. I know we're short for time, but much earlier in my life, when I was a vice president of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation back in the 70s when it just started, I was diagnosed by a dermatologist in Princeton New Jersey, where I was living, with having a mole on the back of my right leg as a malignant melanoma, stage 3. Are there any clinicians in the room? Okay, well, you know that back in the 70s, a level 3 diagnosis was pretty serious stuff, still is, and so we rushed it up the New Jersey Turnpike, the frozen sections, to Sloan Kettering, and it was confirmed a malignant melanoma, but stage 4. So that's pretty much a death sentence at that point. And I was admitted on March 28th on my 36th birthday. And my wife and I, to show you how old this is, how long ago this is, we had just seen Rocky 1. Rocky 1. And you may remember this movie poster. That's what this art is. Of Sylvester Stallone. But in the upper left corner, if you can read that, it's kind of small print. It's, his whole life was a million to one shot. His whole life was a million to one shot. And so I was admitted to Sloan Kettering and went through a whole battery of tests and did wide excision, skin graft, and did more other stuff. And Bob Blendon, a good friend of my wife and mine, brought this movie poster up as a gift. He had somehow gotten a copy from it from the theater. He knew we'd like the movie so much. And we opened it and put that on the wall at the foot of my bed. Now, what do you think the reaction was in the 1970s? This isn't bashing Sloan Kettering. This was at a lot of places because it's a great institution. Was the housekeeping thought, how dare you take down the healing art, the two peaches and a pear that were designed to inspire and motivate you, and put your own stuff. After all, this is our room. We clean it. We work here. You're just a guest in our house. And we had what the State Department would call some animated conversations about that. And they bucked it up to the assistant administrator. We now call them vice presidents and pay them more money. And we had another animated conversation. I can tell you, though, just to really close on this story, was in the middle of the night when I'd wake up anxious as hell or with a full-blown panic attack, because I had less than a year to live at that point, I read those words. That's what I looked at. And that gave me personal courage to say, I'm that one person. Because I kept getting data. Today your odds are 40%. You know, don't you love that? And the next day it would be 52%. Or if the lesion is this many millimeters, we'll take out your lymph nodes or we won't. That, somewhere in the recesses, reminded me the environment. Something as simple. This isn't Picasso. This is just a set of inspiring words. And the ability of patients to have some control over their environment and to be able to bring in their own art or bring in their own music. We talked about the iPod generation. Why are we having 8 people getting cancer chemotherapy over 5 hours, you know, 2 feet away from each other with one blaring television set? And that's our healing environment. We could change that like that. So that's a little bit of why I'm very passionate about this as a form. By the way, the good news was I have an identical twin brother. He's much older. He's 4 minutes older. He's a doctor, and he's not very good looking, but he's one of the, he's not very smart, but he's one of the best looking guys you've ever seen. So he was up at Mass General, and he said, we need a third opinion. And sort of over, so we had a third opinion, and it turned out to be a misdiagnosis. It was a benign Spitz nevus. Nevus is a fancy word for mole, named after Rosemary Spitz, who had discovered it 10 years before, out of all places, Sloan Kettering. So that's my patient story. So let's talk about what we're going to do. There's a lot of evidence, not just intuition, about the connection between the environment that we work and get care in, and clinical outcomes, patient and staff satisfaction, and recruitment and retention. So I'm going to skate through that really quickly and give you a glimpse of what's out there. As Gina said, there's a lot more slides, and I'll refer you to a lot of other things that you can see in the future. The thing that a lot of hospitals confront is we'd like to do these things, have all single-patient rooms, for example, but we can't afford it. Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about wrong. There's a compelling business case for doing this right. And then there's a whole continuum of things that you can do that are, some of which are very low cost. How many are trustees in the room? Okay. How many of you are planning or in the process of building a major renovation. Okay. So about half the room. And it's the single biggest decision from a financial standpoint you will ever make, unless you're a trustee for many years and you do this two or three times. So it's extraordinarily important. But for the rest of you in the room who aren't, there are a lot of very low-cost things you can do, and we'll skate through those quickly in the environment we're already in. So you know about the IOM report. We know it's huge. There are system failures. These risks, this data is well known to you about infections and harm. Premier's right in the middle of all this with pay for performance and others. The nursing turnover issues are out of control. Healthcare workers, you can see those. They're powerless. They're exhausted. And, oh, by the way, nurses have more back injuries than construction workers. I didn't know that until I got into this. So from lifting patients, which is a problem that's getting worse as nurses are getting older. We're not bringing enough new nurses in, and patients are getting bigger and heavier. So I try to do a visual thing here. This is, of course, the six domains of the IOM definition of quality. You're very familiar with it, starting with safety. And I just did a little visual for us this morning. Is think of the connections in noise and color and light and space that connects visually to the six domains. So most hospitals, I think you would agree, are in fact much more stressful and much riskier than they need to be. From some things like basic as, I think the architectural term for wayfinding and signage is it often sucks. We have signs and they're five syllables long, right? And we heard this morning about the level of education of patients. We do not do that kind of thing well. They actually make things worse. And the hunting and gathering that Ann Henrich and others have talked about that nurses spend and away from patient care makes their jobs much tougher. So we can make this help us on the quality improvement journey, or we can actually make it a lot different. Now, Len Berry, some of you may know, is one of my favorite people. He's a marketing professor at Texas A&M, very distinguished person, never done work in healthcare, took a sabbatical, spent a year at Mayo Clinic and others, and this was one of his comments. I mean, his book, The Soul of Service, if you really want to look at a Bible of service industries, is Discovering the Soul of Service. It's been out about 8 years, comparing companies, not healthcare, that really do it well with those that don't do it. But it's the most visible and objective, often sign of respect. And whether you really care, does it feel like the hospital? Does it look clean? Is it quiet? When you look at those questionnaires in Press Ganey or Picker, and you sort of say, how did I feel about my experience? Often these are things you're going to hear much more about. I like this one because, again, it's from a physician, and it's in The Lancet, and it's predicting back several years ago that as evidence-based medicine is making its revolutionary impact, evidence-based design is coming along soon, and I think that's very true. We also know that there is a huge construction boom, and this that should be 71 billion. Part of that is the outrageous costs of construction, concrete, steel, but many hospitals have ended their useful life. So that's a little bit about the context. So what do we mean by evidence-based design? And here's a pretty straightforward definition. It really parallels evidence-based medicine. It's deliberate, and it's attempt to base building decisions on the best available evidence, not winning a Frank Lloyd Wright or whomever architecture award, but what's really the best evidence that connects the environment to clinical or patient satisfaction outcomes. The Center for Health Design, which is like a mini IHI, nonprofit that I've been involved with, did a study of the literature back in 2004. Roger Ulrich and Craig Zimmering, who are both at schools of architecture, and that's all on the center's website. I'll give you that connection a little later. 600 studies about noise and light and single rooms connecting to infections. And so let's just take a little look at that. They kind of organized this in four parts. And this literature review is being updated and will be out in the literature in about 3 months. And there are now 1,200 articles, not 600 articles. So this field is exploding as much as the quality improvement field is. So patient stress, staff stress, patient safety, or other domains of quality. So let's take a quick glance. They kind of developed to get a sense of this, sort of a Zagat restaurant guide scorecard, if you will, of different elements of patients, starting with patient stress. And look at the correlation. This has to do with the amount of research that's out there in a field. And look at the studies on noise. I mean, don't you love to be woken up at 3 a.m. with the overhead paging systems? By the way, we could eliminate overhead paging systems in 60 days. We should get rid of those. Don't you love it if a hotel would do that? Spatial disorientation, that's the signage. Where am I? Improving sleep patterns. So I'm not going to walk through all these, but there's tremendous correlation between the environment and the stress. You might look and say, reduce pain? Really? Roger Ulrich, 1984, University of Pennsylvania, one of the landmark studies, post-surgical patients. Half had a view, were in patient rooms with a view of a brick wall building, and half from a very pastoral, calming nature scene. And there was a statistically significant difference between the two cohorts in terms of length of stay, reduced anxiety, as shown by anti-anxiety medications, and reduced depression through antidepressants. So that's the kind of, when we talk about research in this field, that's the kind of studies we mean. Staff stress, equally important. Burned out, burned up, tired, want to do something else. So noise stress certainly affects people if you're doing 8, 10, 12-hour shifts, every bit as much as patients. And there is more now studies on turnover. This one, the one that's there, shows a real correlation between the environment and turnover. We know the cost of replacing a nurse is about $65,000 to $70,000 when you include the full training costs. And work effectiveness, overall improved worker satisfaction. Lots of research there. Patient safety. Infections. We know we're all dealing with that back home. We know that pay for performance is stopping to pay for hospital acquired infections. There is clearly correlations between the kind of ventilation systems you have, and so that's the airborne infections. Depending on how single patient rooms are clearly correlated with lower infections, just things that you would common sense think. Depending on the configuration and lighting in terms of medication errors. Patient falls can be reduced by as little, besides a change package on a lot of other things, things like wider bathroom doors in the patient room. Well over half of patient falls occur between the bed and the bathroom, or the bathroom and the bed. And just by widening the doors so you can have two caregivers or a caregiver and a family member assisting a patient in and out of a bathroom dramatically reduces, so shows the research, of patient falls. So one-time cost, it's a big impact. And then finally, other domains of quality. We talked about length of stay, drug use, patient transfers. This is one of my favorite. This is in-hospital transfers, not hospital-to-hospital transfers. Takes about 27 steps to transfer a patient. The average transfer rate, I've been working with Jeff Petrie and others at Premier trying to get updated data on that, and frankly, we don't track it. If you'd ask me as a CEO at Children's, how many times on average do you transfer your patients? I didn't know. We just didn't track it. But it seems to be between 3.5 and 4 times. So can you imagine, welcome, Russell, to the Phoenix Biltmore. We're so glad you're here, that you've been here before. We have your profile. We know that you like to stay near the pool and that your wife likes to go to the spa, and we have those things all taken care of, and it's all set. And today you're going to be in room 7207. Tomorrow you're going to be in 7209. Thursday you're going to be in 7314. And we're not sure where you'll be Friday, but we'll find a room for you. Would you be happy? You know? And yeah, we do that to patients all the time, right? We have 3 levels of intensive care, and we're moving back and forth. So the trifecta for me as a CEO is it's a tremendous efficiency win It's a tremendous falls, medication errors, the handoffs we know, and it's a tremendous cost savings. And the patient satisfaction scores are off the charts correlated with whether you have to be moved or not. So I think we should, as a metric, Gina, I think we should think about Quest, seriously, adding two of Blair favorites would be, one of these is what's your transfer, your intra-hospital transfer rate. And maybe we should think of as a North Star goal of 1.0. So not from the ER into a bed, but you're in a bed, and maybe on average, again, average, you might assume there's one transfer from intensive care level of care downward as the hospital, as the patient recovers to med-surg or vice versa. But we ought to track what that is. And if we're transferring patients 3 and 4 times on average in certain units during their stay, what's going on? We can change all that by variable acuity rooms where you put in blood gases in every patient room and telemetry in every patient room. You bring technology to the patients, not force patients to be moved to the technology. And then the only reason patients are moved is because there's a clinical decision by doctors or nurses that it's in their best care to do so, not because, oh, we don't have telemetry in this room, we'll have to move you and start that whole chain. So I think if we could track that, the other would be hand-washing compliance. There is tremendous correlation with hand-washing dispensers as part of a change package to reduce hospital-acquired infections. How many of you have hand-washing dispensers in every patient room today? Okay. One of the things that Don Berwick would say, what can you do by Tuesday or a week from Tuesday, would be to start to do that. And as board members, you could use that as a catalyst, as Maureen and others said so well yesterday, your role, to say, what is our hand-washing compliance rate? Just ask the question. And the answer is you're going to get a dial tone, because we don't know. So how do you figure that out? And it's not that hard to do. As those of you heard Maureen yesterday, you can get some students, you can track it, you can use samples, and you can do some fun things as Cedars did in that example of giving rewards for those that do it really well. But put those right in the line of sight so the doctor and a nurse almost has to fall over it not to comply, okay? Just some examples of things that can really change. So the Quest next month is going to have those two things. Now. But think about it. Wouldn't that be kind of cool to be able to say to your communities that what your hand-washing compliance is? Bottom line, we have a lot of evidence, and it can really reduce stress and harm. So here are the things that research basically says. We talked about larger single bedrooms. If you're designing a hospital, make sure that the rooms are large enough to have three zones, a patient zone, a caregiver zone, and a family zone, so the patients can stay over. Variable acuity we talked about. We talked about noise. I think as we scan this, the positive distraction through the arts, that's my story that I told you about, giving people choice about what they would like in their environment. Now, just like Premier has exemplar hospitals that are leading this, the Center for Health Design has something called the Pebble Project, and some of you, if you might want to consider exploring that. And there are now about 50 of them, and they're, like the metaphor says, create a pebble, create a ripple effect, be a leader, be an exemplar. Here's one of the first, Bronson Methodist. And so they were doing a replacement project back in 2000 when the program started. And these are some of the things they were worried about. You can pick the ones you'd be worried about. And so when they did their research and published their results, they had an 11% decrease in infections because of single patient rooms and some other things they were doing. But that was the main design feature and hand washing facilities. They estimated very conservatively they were saving $500,000 a year in transfers. Now, as a board member or a CEO or a leading clinician, if somebody walked into you and said, about anything, we can save $500,000 a year, whether it was on greening, which we'll hear about, or improving accounts receivable or whatever, that would get your attention, right? They clearly increased their market share. This is in the green as Bronson, and they were in a real Avis and Hertz competitive market. And you can see in 2000, is the year the new Bronson, there's the spike, when the new hospital opened and they dramatically increased consumer preferences, not only because of the building, but their employee satisfaction. How would you like to have a 5.4 nursing turnover rate? That'd be pretty cool. That's what there has been. And their patient experience went way up, as you see. Some of that is a Hawthorne effect with any new building over an old building. I'll admit that. But this stayed with it. And they did a lot of other good things and, by the way, won the Baldrige Award in 2005. So they're an extraordinary organization. But Frank Sardone, the CEO, would tell you that the new design and the physical environment was a key catalyst. Actually enhanced the physical well-being. It helped facilitate the cultural transformation that we're all trying to develop. Now, let's roll up our sleeves and get into the cost next part of this. How much does it really cost? And four colleagues of mine and I wrote an article back in 2004, and it's about the Fable Hospital that Derek Parker, an architect with Anshin and Allen, it was his idea to call it that, in that it was make-believe, it was be the perfect hospital, it hadn't been built. So those of you who are building hospitals, I hope you build Fable Hospitals. So what we made up back then was a 300-bed hospital at a cost of $800,000 a bed. Today it's probably twice that. In crazy California, it's close to $2 million because of not building a Ritz-Carlton, but because of steel and concrete and labor and stuff. With these kinds of values, you see the design features, no surprise there. HEPA filtration, for those of you who aren't an expert, what I'm looking at, Judine, is a fancy name for a much more aggressive filtration system, which makes a difference in immunosuppressed patients. Ceiling lifts. There are now hydraulic ceiling lifts. If you're not thinking about this, I would urge this. Again, it's on the Center for Health Design website. Peace Health, Bend, Oregon, tested this over a 60-month, a five-year period, in two different units, combined with a no-lift of patient agenda, and they literally eliminated back injuries. And as by claims data, so the CFO, as Maureen was saying yesterday, get the CFO involved, he will stand up there and say, I believe these numbers, because he looks at them. So you can literally look at the cost that you're paying out in workers' comp claims going down. So they're actually putting in a brand new hospital they're building, they're putting ceiling lifts in every ceiling, and they're actually implementing them in about half the beds, and the rest they can implement later. So there's another design intervention you could look at. So here's just a sense of the patient zones. This is Methodist. The family zone in the very comfortable area to sleep over. Here's some other design features. This is Bronson looking down into an interior courtyard. So if you don't have Rick Norling San Diego weather, you can still do things interior with an interior garden. This is another view with rooms on the perimeter. Maximizing natural light is huge. And if your architects aren't working with you on that, is enormous. And this area here, this balcony, is actually a patient education center. Okay, so let's dive down. Sorry about this slide. It was done by an ophthalmologist. But it's straight out of the Frontiers article in 2004. So let me give you a couple examples. What we tried to do is we made up this an average, solid, okay hospital, and we said, what if we wanted to build a Fable Hospital? What would the incremental cost be? Now, there's some judgment to this, folks. Believe me, there's as much art as science to this. But we put ourselves out there and said, okay, what would a Fable single patient room, larger room be? We came up with adding an additional 100 square feet. We multiplied those square feet by the 255 single patient rooms of the total, and a dollar per square foot of 185, and we came up with a number. The point is not what is the number, it's the analytical process to go through of what's the difference between baseline and incremental, and that's $4.7 million, one-time upfront capital cost. So if you added, remember all those design features, we did that with every one, variable acuity rooms, hand-washing dispensers. Some of them are very small numbers, some are larger numbers. Single patient rooms, larger was the biggest one. We came up with $12 million. or 5%. So remember, $240 million as our base went to $252 million. That would be kind of the difference. Okay, then what we got into the other side of the ledger, which we typically don't do in building new hospitals. And it's the craziest thing is you guys as trustees approve a new MRI, a new CAT scanner. You want that ROI all the time. You do that as routine. But you have a $300 or $400 million project, and we don't look at what's the ROI. We just look at, we have a budget of $240 million. We can't afford the extra 12, right? We get in that first cost mentality. So let's dive in here. We just tried, based on another pebble, Clarion Methodist in Indianapolis, and the average cost of a transfer that was in the data was between $250 and $300. They reduced through variable acuity rooms and a lot of nursing education. Believe me, it's not just the facility, stupid. It is also the whole culture. So if you expect different kinds of nurses with different kinds of training, all of a sudden, oh, you're going to love this variable acuity room and have no conversation, they're going to go running, screaming into the night because they're not going to like it. And that's what happened. Ann Hendrick will tell you. So they did a whole training program back, and that's one of their learnings. But look at the decrease, and that's a $3.8 million saving. It's enormous. Falls. The average unlitigated cost is $10,000. And here's the problem of averages. You guys know a fall can be a bump in the elbow or it can be a head injury that is a 30-day stay in an ICU, which is major costs. So it's an average issue, but you have to have some kind of number to work with. Here's the median falls per 1,000 patient days, a number I never knew about my own organization. It probably doesn't apply as much to pediatrics in this case. But again, by the design of some of the things we talked about, substantially we're able to reduce falls. And so we did the math. We didn't take any credit for litigation avoidance, even though that could be enormous because it's very speculative and we're trying to be conservative. But it's still a big number. Hand washing. We're updating this whole business case analysis and this article. A new article will be out in 3 months. And the business case has just gotten stronger, you know, and one of which is pay for performance is not going to pay for hospital-acquired infections. So part of the cynicism where you get back and say, well, you know, I know we average an extra length of stay, but we're on a per diem reimbursement, so we're getting paid for it. It really didn't hurt us that badly financially. Those days are over. So this cost of infections has gone up dramatically. The experts will tell you they're much more multi-resistant. They're much more complicated. It takes much more resources to treat. So rolling this up very quickly, you see the components and the drug cost reduction. That, in retrospect, I think is probably overstated, but that's the reduced anxiety, reduced depression from a better environment, is $7.8 million. Now, that's an operating savings. You're going to get that back every single year. Let's go over to the revenue side. If you're in a Bronson environment, and you're in a very competitive, where additional market share is important to you. They estimated a 1.5% increase in volume, and that was their dollar number. You may find, if you do this analysis, that you have the market, or it's not that competitive. Same thing with philanthropy. In my own experience, a number of people like to give to a great project. We're going to build the safest hospital in the state of Michigan or California. Bottom line is, it's a big number. Now, if you want to cut that in half, just cut that in half and say, well, some of those might not apply to us. What if you made a one-time $12 million investment and you got 5.5 back in year one? By year three, you would have paid for that incremental cost. If you have a life cycle on a hospital of 50 years or 40 years, the rest of that is just pure win. So that's the business case. And as this shows, if you invested that money you saved, you could have paid for the whole thing. So this whole thing of life cycle and first cost is huge. Now, if we're going to do this, how do we make this happen? Well, you have to ask a new question. And in the years I was CEO, our board, when we did a new project, we asked these five questions. I'm running short of time, so I'm going to go really quickly. They're familiar to you. Urgency, do you really need it? sometimes, you know, you're skeptical. Do we really need to do this? Are the market assumptions sound? Is this the right response to replace the whole hospital or to maybe do some condominium or satellite arrangements in other locations? How expensive is this? One of my trustees call it the Ford Cadillac question. We don't want to build a Cadillac. You know, we want to build kind of a median cost per square foot. This is the CFO question. What's the impact when the depreciation comes online in 3 to 4 years on the balance sheet? And are we really going to get that incremental volume? And where are we getting the money from between reserves, borrowing, philanthropy? Are those solid? And I'm saying to you today, you need to ask a sixth question. And have you incorporated the evidence-based design features into this new building? And it's a key fiduciary responsibility. And kind of wrapping this up, then long-term, some of the things we've talked about, you've seen where you're doing a major construction project, these things you should really, really look at and work on as part with your architects, with your clinical leaders, and get them fully engaged in what having a variable acuity rooms throughout the hospital, reducing that transfer way down. You see those. In the short term, we talked about hand-washing dispensers. You can do things like reducing noise. You can do a noise audit of your hospital for $5,000 to $10,000. There's some firms out there that will come in with just, you know, the noise is, you know, it's like a pedometer, but it measures noise. And there's WHO decibel levels about what are acceptable noise levels, and they can... You can, after just a two-day visit of walking around, they'll give you a report, and where are the worst offenders? The ice machine right outside the patient room. Get it out of there, you know. The overhead paging we talked about, or other things. Some of those are just process improvements. Others are things like dampening the floors and ceiling tiles and things like that, and you just need to cost those out, whether you can afford to do that in the short run. But they're enormously beneficial in terms of patient satisfaction and staff satisfaction. So those are some short-term things you can do. Here's a little bit about the center. If you want to get any of this info, that's a great book that has a lot of this material in it. And their website, just like Premier, it's open. All the stuff is available. Have fun with it and go get it. So including, and before I, as I'm turning it over to Gina, what I'm excited about is that as we enter the quality, continue on the quality improvement journey, the business case for creating the right kind of internal environment is very strong and very compelling. It involves getting your CFO on board. It involves making a set of assumptions and then managing the organization to those assumptions. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm going to spend the last couple of minutes just sharing with you some of the resources that are available for both safety and green design from Premier. And in your on each of the tables, there was a packet of information which has many of the things that I'm going to just mention briefly and tell you about our website that has a lot of this. The Center for Health Design is one of these many resources that are available to you as you plan your green and safer hospitals. Oh God. Hold on a second. My slides are not in the packet. My slides are just a summary of what you have in those handouts that you have. So you probably know that Premier is very proud that we are the first group purchasing organization to win a National Environmental Award for our program, and we've won it for 5 consecutive years. The real issue that brings us to green and safer design is why should we care? And we heard a lot of information about why we should care from Blair. But just a couple of pieces of information. A recent CDC study that showed that newborns have 287 chemicals per child, 180 of them known to be cancer-producing. We've read all about the toxicity to mercury, and one study showed that 10% of women have enough mercury in their blood to cause neurological damages to their fetus. We have terribly soaring energy prices, the impact from our carbon greenhouse gas emissions and its impact on health and global warming is tremendous. And the United States leads the way in increasing our greenhouse gas emissions each year, another area that we have a challenge for. Mercury health risk, 2,500 North American lakes have mercury-contaminated fish, and we know that it persists in the environment for decades. Another challenge we have is dioxin, which is a known carcinogen formed and manufactured during manufacturing and incineration. DEHP is a toxin that's used to soften plastics. We know it leaches from medical devices. It's been linked to birth defects. And FDA has warned of the hazards in certain populations. And we can't get labeling of medical devices for DEHP. So we also have seen an increase in certain health conditions over the last couple of years, possibly linked to toxic exposures in the environment. The increase in cases of asthma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and breast cancer over the last couple of years is really very alarming. And some of this is likely related to environmental exposures. And, of course, the tremendous waste that we produce and 6,000 tons of solid waste per day that hospitals generate, much of it the packaging and the paper and cardboard. And computer waste, of course, is our fastest growing waste stream and all the toxins in it. Much of that waste ends up overseas where they don't have laws for where to put this. Our food source is also a problem, with 70% of our chickens getting arsenic as a growth promoter, lots of antibiotics promoting antibiotic resistance as a problem. So Premier has a very expansive program. I'm not going to go into it in detail, but just to tell you, it has a lot of different components. It has a corporate component where internally we do things to make sure Premier is green. We recycled 5 tons of IT equipment, for example. We have tools and resources on our safety website, which I'll show you about, and newsletters for our members. In the supply chain, we make sure we contract with environmentally preferable contracts and get those products in our catalogs and available to members and searchable, and a website where we actually list the products. One of your handouts shows some of those products that we have under contract, just a selection of them. Lots of advocacy going on. We were one of the only group purchasing organizations to give testimony to the FDA to ask for a science-based approach to reuse of single-use devices and not based on fear. And we were able to get that and influence the FDA's position on reuse of single-use devices. And in the educational space, we do a lot of educational programs. This particular program, this will also be available as a download audio file for your iPod, if you wish, to listen to this or to share it with somebody that couldn't attend. Our Safety Institute is where we house all this information. It's a publicly accessible website. We get 5 million hits a year, lots of incredible information on green, on safety, safety of the patient, of the worker, of the products, and of the environment. And I just picked just the green topics on there. We have over 40 topics on the website. These are just the topics that we have for green, lots on greener, safer design as well. We have a very popular website. It's just a snapshot. If you search computers, electronics, and healthcare, Premier's website comes up number one out of 39 million sites. So it's a very robust website with lots of fabulous information on green topics in healthcare. In your packet, I also put a CEO scorecard. Our executives asked for some way that they could do an analysis, a high-level analysis of kind of where they were, where was their low-hanging fruit. And so we developed this scorecard to help CEOs actually look at what they're doing in the hospital along a lot of different green initiatives, which fall under the jurisdiction of many different departments in the hospital. On our Public Safety Institute website, we have something called Green Corner, where we have 50 case studies on the whole spectrum of green, from energy to food to recycling, what our hospitals are doing that's very exciting, what some of our suppliers are doing in terms of LEED. And so lots of case studies to look at if there's a particular initiative that your hospital may be involved in. Also in your packet is just, I've pulled up some of our selected contracts in the green space. We have a public website where we post information on all of our suppliers in each of the categories, recycling, mercury-free, PVC-free, DEHP-free, so that you have an opportunity to look and see who the suppliers are without getting a special password to the catalog where all the details of those contracts are. So I'm going to end here. So we end on time at 45 minutes. I want to thank you so much for your attendance to this session. And Blair Sadler and I are happy to stay over for those of you that may have any specific questions about what you've heard today. Thank you very much.